Session number 3971, reel number one.
Mr. O'Neill, Reel 1. What was your family background?
Well, my father was an optician and we lived in Manchester. There was no newspaper of a photographic bent in the family, but early on, somehow I became interested in photography, probably because of one of my uncles who was a keen amateur photographer. And he showed me what it was all about. And I remember one of the first pictures I ever took was of the Fenians, now the IRA, marching through Manchester, as they did annually, to commemorate the hanging of two of their members in Salford Prison. And I was about 14, I think, at the time, and I took this picture with him as they marched down a wet Manchester street on a Sunday afternoon, and we went back and developed it in the cellar with a red light and very slow golden ISO zenith plates, and thought no more of it. The next morning when we woke up, we found that the Fenians had planted bombs in Manchester, two of which had gone off and one had killed somebody. I had no news sense, of course, about taking the picture up to one of the newspapers to see if it was any use, even though it was 24 hours late. Possibly that was the first thought I had about joining newspapers and so-called exciting life of a pressman.
Did you feel tempted to stay with your father's trade as an optician?
No, not at all. See, my father had died when I was about 9 years old, so there's no influence there at all.
How about your education? Did you enjoy schooling?
Yes, I was very lucky. I got a scholarship to the Severian College in Manchester. It's a Catholic college there. But any promise I'd shown as a pupil didn't materialize, and I left there when I was 14. I was really fed up with schooling, and I really wanted to get into papers, get out and earn a living. And I got an interview with the Express, who were always on the lookout for messenger boys, the Daily Express in Ancoat Street, Manchester. And I was taken on as a messenger boy at 10 shillings a week. And again, I was very lucky. I was put onto the art desk. And the art desk there was run by Fife Robertson, who's now the well-known TV commentator, and as his assistant he had Frank Spooner, who later became picture editor of the Daily Express in London and now runs his own picture agency. And I think it was there that I really got to know what pictures were all about, because we were receiving pictures from our own staff photographers from agencies all over the world, and the pace was extremely, extremely hard. We used to work from work at night while 2 o'clock in the morning, 6 days a week, and Saturday was the only day off. And I remember that one of the first pictures made an impact on me was the burning of the Hamburg when it crashed at sea. And we were in the office about 1:30 in the morning, all waiting to catch the 2 o'clock bus home. And then the flash came through, and about, it seems quite remarkable for those days, this was 1938, a wire picture arrived on the desk of the Hindenburg burning on the airfield at New Jersey. It's still a historic picture, it's always pulled in now when people talk about great pictures. And we were there till about 5 o'clock in the morning, they're running extra editions on that one. So that was the first time. First big picture I really remember on newspapers.
What was it like working generally?
It's very interesting. I mean, see, we got through more pictures in a night there than the average newspaper does in a week here. I think we used to get something like 300, 400 pictures in, and every hour from 6 o'clock onwards there was an edition going to press. And for each edition, the complete back page — in those days the back page was always pictures — the complete back page was changed with 10 pictures, and of course the inside pictures were changed to suit the locality, because we used to print for Northern Ireland, north of England, right down to the Midlands. And so it's pretty hectic all the while. So consequently, again, you saw not only the international wire agents, you saw your own staff, men's pictures, men you knew, like people like Norman Midgley, who was in the film unit with me later on, people there. Gave a very good insight into what the business was about. And Frank Spooner was very decent to me. He gave me an old Gertz press cancel, the old stringed line. It took 5-4 plates, and you altered the exposure by adjusting the string on the blind at the back. And I started taking pictures with this on the old 9-12 plates, not very successfully, but I was getting some idea. I had no darkroom training at all. And I thought of Fox Photos at that time were the only London agency operating in the north. They had an office in Manchester. So I went along to Fox with the swing of Frank Spooner, who knew the then news editor of of Fox Photos in Manchester, and got a job there as a messenger boy. And so on this instance, I came into contact with the actual production of pictures and how they're obtained. And there were two chaps there, one Harry Shepherd, who is now dead, and Frank Martin. Again, strange enough, he was in the film unit and he was killed in the desert. Two very young London photographers, but very, very good men. And I used to go out with Harry Shepherd on assignments at weekends when I was free, and got to know the taking side of the business. And of course they had their own dark rooms, of course, in Manchester. And I got some knowledge of darkroom operation, and the rest really I read up from books. So really it was I was self-taught, one might say.
Did you get to know people like Fife Robertson very well? Did he, as well as Frank Spooner, encourage you to go on to photography? Was he a distant figure?
No, he wasn't a distant figure. He was a very humane figure. He was a much respected man, and but from a photographic assistant's point of view, no, because quite frankly his art editor was too darn busy. You know, he'd be in about 2:30 or 3:30, and he'd be hard at it until about 2 in the morning. That was the reason I went really to Fox Photos, where it was just that little more time for people to show you to show you things and for you to ask questions.
What sort of photography were you doing with Fox Photos?
Well, we were going out. I remember going down to Castle Donington for the motor races, where the old German auto unions were sweeping the board, and we used to cover the Grand National and things like that. But I didn't take the pictures. I was, you know, purely there as a boy, and on the odd occasion, if it was a quiet story, I'd take a picture. But I was really learning the business as opposed to taking pictures for distribution through the through the agency. Mind you, on Saturday, of course, there was always a rush on an agency because of football matches, on rugby matches, and I used to cover the odd football match for them. Manchester United, which in those days was a much quieter place than I believe it is now. Following weekend, Manchester City. And I was, I'd be about 15 and a half or so. But age didn't seem to be remarkable, because the photographers in Manchester at that time were young men, chaps about 23, 24.
Your break came in the war years, and you managed to get into photography fair and square as a profession. How exactly did this come about?
Well, the war started, and almost immediately many of the photographers were called up because they were all young men. I continued working with Fox, but never took any. Actually, was employed by them as a cameraman. I looked around, and I found the Sunday Express were in need of a photographer. They had no photographers at all, and also the Daily Mirror, who didn't print in Manchester but only had an office there, wanted a photographer, particularly to work the night shift, because there was the imminence of bombing, night bombing throughout the country, and they wanted somebody to cover this. So I used to work at nights for the Daily Mirror and 3 days a week on the Express. Luckily, for all concerned, the only time Manchester was bombed was for a period of 3 days. And I went out covering this. It wasn't the hectic great explosion scene one imagines. It was rather, you know, building because of incendiaries. No fire engines around because there were far too many fires for them to cope. And it was not sort of a sole spectator going up, seeing a building burning, taking a picture of it and going away, and the streets were empty. Quite remarkable. Plus the fact that carrying a camera in those days was prohibited, if I remember rightly, it was prohibited by law, and you had to prove you're a press man to be able to do so. Well, I wasn't a union member, I was too young. Nobody ever stopped me, and there I was wandering around Manchester photographing burning buildings.
Did you ever hear of anybody who was doing something similar to what you were doing, ever being arrested and getting into trouble for this very reason?
No, there was a great regard then for the defence laws, and there was no occasion, nothing like that at all. In fact, the security was very, very good. We all knew where, or people in the area knew where the arms factories were, and secret establishments and like that, but there was never any conversation about them, never any instance of people talking wildly about where these places were. No.
Did you ever photograph any dead bodies? For example, I guess during this period that there was a general ban or a very great reluctance of people photographing the Blitz casualties.
Yes, I suppose that we were influenced by propaganda, let's put it quite bluntly, and one didn't photograph those kind of things. So strange enough, I never saw any dead bodies in Manchester. When they bombed Manchester, bombed the centre, they were mostly cotton warehouses, office blocks, no one, not even caretakers as far as I know, and they were hit with incendiaries, more than high explosives, and they just burnt.
How long did this period of freelancing for the Sunday Express and the Daily Mirror last?
That went on for about, until I joined the army. And until I was called up, which was when I was 18, they called you up, you know, bang on the day, you were 18. And I was preparing for this. I knew that I could have gotten into the RAF, because most photographers went in the RAF because RAF photographic units need a lot of men. But a chap I'd worked with at Fox Photos, John Horton, who now works for PA Reuter Photos, his father was the very well-known Bill Horton, who was chief photographer of the Times. And old Bill, as we used to call him, he was Churchill's personal photographer, also used to go away with the King when he went on military visits, and he also was head of the section of Army PR operating at Curzon Street, who received all the still pictures back from the various war fronts, and there they were developed, printed, processed and sent out to the C of I, not the C of I, it was the Ministry of Information then, and he was in charge of that. And so I got in touch with him, and he said, well, to get in the Army Film Unit, you obviously join the Army and then apply for a transfer, which I thought was all going to be very nice and easy. So they put me in the Army into the Lancashire Fusiliers, sent me up for training at Strensall Camp in Yorkshire, and then I spent the next 18 months putting in transfers to the Army Film Unit and moving up and down England with the infantry on exercises and one thing and another as a fusilier. I had my camera with me at the time. I don't think this was allowed, but it didn't matter very much because they were all very in the regiment having their pictures taken, and we used to wait for night to fall. I know on occasion in bell tents up on the moors at Catterick, wait for the night to fall and then push everybody out of the bell tent. While eyes developed the plates, still on plates, no roll films, under a blanket up there, and then did contact prints. Well, I suppose it did something to alleviate the boredom of infantry training.
Were you allowed to become the unit's sort of semi-official photographer, or was this just an
No, not really. There was no such thing in the infantry. But the fact that I got on very well with the quartermaster sergeant helped a lot, because he was, you know, rather got all my next to the RSM, so I got one or two facilities there. But my transfer came through. It wasn't a transfer. It was arranged for me to go to London to be interviewed for the Army Film Unit. They were setting up number 5 Army Film Unit for the invasion of Europe. And I went down there with another chap who was a reporter, a fellow called John Clayton. And we were interviewed, and as I mentioned, the first question we were asked, have you any objections to joining the commandos or the airborne forces, the parachutists, if you're a photographer? So with our tongue in our cheek and fingers crossed and hoping it would never happen, we said yes. And then place at the hotel in Paddington Station, I should think there were about 4 chaps there, and I think they're vacant about 30, no more. Strange enough, on the board was an officer out of the Lancashire Fusiliers, a chap called Palmer. And it's possible that this, you know, might have swayed it a bit. I don't know. And I think that Bill Horton had kept coming along. Anyhow, I thought I was very, very lucky to be selected, and I never returned to the Lancashire Fusiliers. It was on there. By this time, they're on Dartmoor. And, my equipment was sent up, and I went straight away to Pinewood Studios for training.
Did you enjoy that brief period, or the 18-month period from February 1942 to May 1940 in the army, or was the prospect of getting out one which appealed to you immensely?
Oh, the prospect of going into the Army Film Unit appealed immensely, because this is why I joined the army, and infantry life had no appeal whatsoever for me. Just didn't click. Well, we did the job. I mean, to say it was a very boring time. Exercises all the time, lying on your stomach on a Sunday morning in the middle of a Yorkshire village, repelling invisible invaders and all this kind of thing. But things at Pinewood were very different, because to start off with, we were housed in what were comparatively luxury quarters. They were the old dressing rooms for the film sets. Also, there was a much less discipline there. No square bashing and no stamping up and down, all the rest. We're concentrating on training to be photographers. Again, I was lucky. I think about half the chaps on the course had been professional photographers. The other half were either amateurs or had no experience at all. But of course, in true army style, being a still photographer, they immediately started training me to be a cine photographer. And we're very lucky. We had Les Carpenter and Len Harris, who were very, very good instructors. And I think that no one failed the course. I'm pretty sure of that.
How did they go around training you in cine photography?
Well, the usual way. We had the technical training first of all, and then the practical. And of course, on the cine side, it was absolutely fascinating. You know, you'd shoot movies in the morning and go to the theatre in the afternoon to see them. And this was quite a thing, the speed at which they did the processing, so you could see your faults. That, in the training, I say, was very good. I mean, a professional film man coming into the unit would have differing views, but for myself as a still photographer and talking about cine training, yes, it was very good.
Do you think it would have equipped you for being a studio cameraman, or was
Oh, no, because studio work would involve much greater concentration on lighting, and this didn't come into it because we worked with daylight all the time. I don't think I ever took any shots by artificial light or studio lighting at all.
Was this a point which was made clear to you at the time, that you were being trained only up to a certain proficiency in cinematography, and that the finesse of photography as such was being left out of the whole question?
No. No, it never came through, and I looked at it. They trained us sufficiently for the job we had to do.
What sort of cameras were they training you on?
Vintons, and there was the odd IMO, which was jealously guarded by the senior men, because there were all ranks on the course, ranging from sergeant down to private. And from the stills, we were issued with Iconters, which I believe there was a great shortage of, but managed to come through when a unit was being formed in sufficient quantities. You know, the Iconter was made in Germany, and they were purchased by the British purchasing agent in Switzerland, who used to get them from Germany to Switzerland over here, which is very good, because we had no comparable camera on the still side. But the Cine, the Vinton was English-made camera, of course.
Do you think the Cine equipment you had was good for the job?
Oh, yes. It was simple, it was easy, and it didn't very often go wrong.
Hanley, at the end of your three-month training period at Pinewood, did you have to pass a trait test?
Yes, though you're really assessed on your efforts and behaviour over the past 3 months. Though there's no obvious discipline, it was a pretty well-disciplined unit. No one ever stepped out of line, because they knew it was only too easy to be returned to unit, and most of the blokes there were there because they wanted to be there. It was a job they wanted to do. It was an interesting job, no two ways about it.
Was there anybody returned to unit?
Not as far as I know, or I can remember, no. Which proves that the original selection must have been fairly good.
Did you have to pass a battle course, a drill course for the Irish Guards?
Oh, yes. They took us a unit down to the Irish Guards at Chelsea Barracks, the old Chelsea Barracks, of course. And we were initiated into the mysteries of Brigade of Guards training, which was very disciplinarian, but not too hard, because we used to work from about 8 o'clock in the morning till midday, and that was it. And this consisted of square bashing and small arms training and the rest of it, but really great accent on the drill. And then we had to pass out, of course, for that. And after that, we went with the Irish Guards at Lingfield, at Hobbs Barracks at Lingfield, where we did battle training. And this was a much tougher existence. I didn't notice it so much, because I was then, what, about 20, was I? And I was the youngest in the unit. Most of the chaps were 28 to 40, and they hadn't been in infantry units as I had, so I was fit. And I was young, and they certainly found it harder going than I did. So it wasn't too hard for me. I'd been used to it. I had 18 months of this before with the Fusiliers. And after the chat, we passed out there, and I think that's when we got the our stripes, the sergeant stripes.
Do you think this twin period of discipline of the guards and the battle training was relevant for the experience you're about to go through?
Battle training certainly was, because I know that it brought a lot of the chaps in the unit into proximity of weapons that were going off all around them in battle. I mean, say, some came from the RASC, some came from the Royal Artillery, and they'd had no battle training as such. They didn't know what it was about. And this battle training, of course, was a simulation of what you'd come across. As for the square bashing at Chelsea Barracks, well, I suppose it's very difficult to knock a bunch of 30 characters, again from various regiments, into a cohesive unit so they look as though they're all soldiers together. Let me say, some of the chaps had never been on the square in their lives. They'd been in offices and Lord knows what else. So to a certain extent, I suppose, the square bashing and the Scots Guards discipline was worthwhile. But certainly the battle training was very worthwhile.
You were talking earlier about the level of discipline in No. 5 Army Film and Photo Section and saying that, in fact, it was self-imposed. What sort of relationship was there between the officers and men?
I found it quite remarkable because I'd come from an infantry unit where discipline was strict and there was really no contact between the officers and the men except on official occasions, and it was all very formal and the rest of it. It was much different in the film unit. It was much more free and easy, much more camaraderie there. At least this is what I found.
Why do you think that was the case?
Well, I suppose that the film and newspaper business produced people who, well, whose job it was to get on with all kinds of people and no formality. And this was continued when they went into the services. Also, so many of the chaps in the units had known each other in civilian life, and there was no false pretences held there. That's why it's probably quite remarkable that ever would you get a unit where men had actually worked alongside each other in civilian life, all together in the same unit during the war. And they also had a very good assessment of the other bloke's professional abilities too.
Do you think that the rank of sergeant was a good rank for your function?
It's about the lowest you could do the job with. I would have thought that warrant officer rank would have been better. On the other hand, in actual operation, one found that people not knowing the army film unit, having a chap come along, and a soldier with a camera, was something unusual, and you could get a lot of things done because of the unusual situation, I'm phrasing that rather badly. What I mean is that when you turned up on a job, they never seen anything like you before, so I suppose it didn't really matter whether you were a sergeant or a warrant officer.
A warrant officer being?
Colour sergeant or a sergeant major. It would have been a disadvantage to be an officer, because as an officer going, say, to a disciplined unit like an infantry unit or, say, the Brigade of Guards, no way would that officer get real pictures of the average soldier. Whereas, probably as a sergeant, you stood a bit of a better chance.
Do you think generally the question of rank was not as important as, say, the novelty of somebody turning up with a camera?
Precisely. And of course, all the soldiers wanted to be photographed. They were the biggest camera hogs ever.
Was there a deliberate sort of policy on the part of cameramen to take lots of pictures, still pictures, of soldiers just to get their way into a unit? Did you do that, for example?
No, because we had a very good backup service. And I don't think we were ever told directly, but we certainly knew that when we went out to photograph a unit, we went out to photograph it, irrespective of what anybody tried to tell us from the unit at the time or try and steer us into. Our job was to photograph it as we've been taught to photograph it, knowing the requirements of PR at the War Office, and get on with the job.
How important was a pass in this connection?
I don't think I ever carried one. Can't remember. But they were well briefed at the units when we arrived and what we were going to do, and they rather left us on our own to get on with the job. It was a little interference.